Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, worry no longer. Tara Reid is back. Now, she didn't tweet a lot, but she let us know that she's been in Canada recently with infected mushroom. And so I have a feeling the tweets are going to start coming in because she hadn't tweeted in like a week. How are you?
Saying she's in Canada with infected mushroom makes it sound like she's got some sort of disease called infected mushroom. Like, she's being treated in Canada for infected mushroom.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably better ways to phrase this. I feel like at some point she's going to become like the Tobias Funke of Twitter, where things are just poorly worded all the time, and someone's going to have to say, maybe you should start proofreading these before they go through.
Maybe. I want to talk to you, before we do our Bulls thing, I want to talk to you about Gary Payton.
Oh, I love me some Gary Payton.
Did you happen to read the thing I wrote this morning?
I have it tabbed. I saw the headline, essentially, of like John Stockton was tougher to guard than Michael Jordan, correct?
Yeah, it was a really interesting discussion that, of course, everyone decided to just comment on the headline on Twitter, which is great.
You love that.
I love that. That's one of my favorite things. If you're listening to this, please don't ever comment to me on something then when you just read the headline and want to object to it. And you could say, well, didn't you write the headline to get reactions? I'm like, yeah, but I wrote the headline to get a reaction, and the reaction I want is for you to click it. That's all I care about.
Right.
I don't really care about what you think. I just want the click. Just kidding. I love your discussion.
No, he doesn't.
No, I really don't. But so he talked about Payton, and one of the things that he was talking about with him versus Jordan is his big thing was John never let anything get to him. No matter how much I bugged him defensively with my effort or intensity or with my trash talking, he never got bothered, and he always made the smart play. And Mark Spears of Yahoo did a great Q&A with Payton in advance of his Hall of Fame enshrinement on Sunday, in which Stockton will present him along with George Gervin, they asked Payton, you know, he said that Stockton was the toughest guy to guard. What about Jordan? And he said, you know, I could get to Jordan. There are things that you can say that get under his skin and influences the way that he plays. Now, Jordan is, you know, notorious for punishing people that pissed him off, like
right.
Just absolutely ripping apart people that made him angry. But it got me thinking about this kind of idea of, I think in football it's evident they play better when they're angry because it's an aggressive sport, right?
Right.
The same is probably true of hockey, though I'm not educated enough on the sport to be able to identify it. I don't know whether baseball is because I don't really understand the mental mechanics behind baseball. I would go insane if I had to be at a baseball park more than once a week. I would go insane. I would just go absolutely crazy because there's so much activity of nothingness that goes on. I would be on my phone in like left field. That's what I would be doing.
Sure.
But in basketball, I feel like there's a very big differential between centers and forwards and guards. I think that the centers and forwards are improved by being angry and using that as motivation, and guards are most times, not every time, but most times compromised by a level of aggression caused by anger.
Yeah, I think it depends on what your role is. I think if you're a distributor and it turns you into more of a scorer, when you get angry, I think that's a good thing for the defense. I think the opposite. I think if you're more of a scorer and it turns you into someone who tries to then pick apart the defense when you get angry, I think that's actually a benefit because – I can't believe this is my reference point. But in the movie Celtic Pride
– Here we go.
In the movie Celtic Pride, he catches the Celtics off guard when – what's his name? It's something Scott. Lewis Scott, played by Damon Wayans. When Lewis Scott starts passing the ball around, one, he hilariously hits a teammate in the face who's not expecting to pass. And two, he it kind of opens up everything to where he can pass, he can score. And so I think it depends on what your kind of mentality is. Like, I think if you pissed off Monte Ellis and Monte Ellis just started trying to pick you apart instead of just scoring on you all the time, I think that would be huge. If you pissed off like Chris Paul and he starts going at you from a scoring standpoint, I actually think that can be a detriment to the Clippers in a way. I mean, obviously Chris Paul doing whatever the hell he's going to do isn't that bad for his team. But I think there's a certain level of you kind of want to take those guys out of what they do if they're distributors, right? Because then it's limiting the options that can hurt you.
Get ready. We're actually gonna we have an actual argument. So Bulls fans are gonna have to wait on talking about Derrick Rose. Okay, so I would actually argue the exact opposite. I feel very strongly the exact opposite. I'm basing this off of anecdotal evidence. I said this morning, I look forward to the day when we have biometric data to basically be able to say at X point there was an altercation and for Y time period afterwards his blood pressure was up, his heart rate was up, like he showed all the signs of basic aggression, and that impacted his play. Why? Like, I think it's gonna be really fascinating to look at. It won't be definitive, but I think it'll be really interesting. By basing this off of anecdotal evidence, which is my two guys are Kobe and Carmelo. And the thing that I've noticed is whenever Kobe, something happens and Kobe's supposed to get mad, everyone's like, uh-oh, they angered the Mamba. And what inevitably happens is he dribbles into a double team and takes a contested falling away jumper with two guys draped all over him. And if he hits one, it's awesome, but he does that consistently to a point where he starts taking even worse shots than usual. And this is not a guy with a whole lot of shot selection to begin with because he can hit a lot of crazy things. But he actually ends up increasing, in my opinion, they wind up increasing the difficulty of their shots, and you're very rarely going to do that. With Paul, my thing has always been he's way too – he defers way too much to the point where not from the perspective of passing – he'll have entire quarters where he's like, I'm going to dribble the ball up, give it to a wing, and then go sit in the corner for a while. And he just chills out, and like a lead's evaporating. And I'm sitting there, and this has been happening since he was with the Hornets, where I'm sitting there yelling, like, Paul, what are you doing? Like, go take over. They need you. Now, some of that is primarily the fact that Chris Paul is he's very smart in terms of his body, and he takes games off because he doesn't care. And he's really learned to manage that. He's talked openly about pacing himself. But I feel like when he does get angry and when he gets into that mode, him as a scorer is a terrifying proposition because you can't stop worrying about his pass. You're constantly going to be worried about it. But he's such an efficient scorer. You're talking about a guy that's flirted with 50, 40, 90 before, and he's so smart with a shot selection because it's inherent in his play style. I feel like that anger only makes him more difficult. I would much rather – I want to keep Chris Paul complacent and kind of disengaged, and I want to try and get Carmelo Anthony or Kobe Bryant jacking up 35-footers with two guys in their face.
I agree about Kobe and Carmelo. I disagree about Chris Paul. When he is – I think what you're describing is him not engaging, whereas what I'm describing is him – just running the offense rather than like just giving the ball up and then going and standing in the corner. Like, I think those are right. Two completely different things.
You want more in like picking you apart, assassin mode.
Yeah.
Always making the right decision.
Right.
Versus purposefully trying to make a point. Yeah.
Exactly. That's more what I mean. Just interestingly enough, while you, when you said that, I looked up Chris Paul's career when he scores 30 points or more in a game. His teams are 31-15. That's not bad.
Yeah.
That's all right.
That's what's crazy. And it makes you wonder if he played in a different era, like what his play style would have been. To me, that's like a really interesting question. The same way I look at like how good – because I was watching Gary Payton highlights this morning, and I was looking at like how good would Gary Payton be in this like NBA in terms of his passing ability. But then you look at also, okay – he couldn't hand check. Like, what's that going to do to his defense? It's this really interesting question of kind of trying to put these players in different eras, and you can't do it. It's just fun to think about. You don't need to draw any sort of big conclusions about their worth. It's just interesting to see how it would have affected them.
Right. I funny enough, I was watching the NB80s shows on NBA TV this morning, which are fantastic, by the way. I highly recommend. I got into a marathon of them, so if you can find those on NBA TV again, they're really great. But they were talking about Tiny Archibald, and that when you said what Chris Paul would look like in a different era, that's immediately what popped in my head. I was thinking this guy would probably, like, if he played in the 70s and 80s, he'd probably lead the league in scoring and assists in the same year, which Archibald is the only player to ever do that in NBA history. Like, that's, I think he would kind of find that hybrid pretty nicely.
So I think getting back to the original point, it's this really interesting question of would you rather, you know, with Jordan, the fact that you could get to him, because it was also interesting from the perspective of, I think what Peyton was talking about is how it felt to guard him versus the actual results. Because if you're guarding somebody, you can't really look at the results and go, I think it's one of the things that happens a lot is you have these so few opportunities. I mean, I think of it this way, talking to Iguodala when he was talking about guarding Carmelo or whatever, he's guarded him enough times, he's got certain things that he'll go to that he knows that he likes to do, so he tries to take him away from him. But Iguodala is not a guy that's going to – and Iguodala is one of the smarter defenders out there. He's not going to look at results and change his entire process because of whatever the results are, because he's going to say, well, no, I know that he likes to do this, and I know that this has been effective against him because I've done it. Like, I've
right.
played against and I've seen him be agitated or distracted or frustrated. And it's almost an interesting kind of corollary to the stats versus watch the games dispute. Only you kind of have to give the player the benefit of the doubt because he's the one that's actually doing it. So if Gary Payton says, I felt like I did a better job against Jordan than I did against John Stockton, even though Jordan lit him up. I mean, Jordan averaged 30 against Payton in his career.
Yeah.
But he did on 24 shots. It was funny because I looked at the numbers and for the career, and some of that's a lot of noise because they're the end of the careers for both guys. But it was 49% for Jordan for his career versus 47% against Payton. So it was like a drop, but it wasn't anything really noticeable. Like, Jordan still averaged 30 points on 47%.
Quite good, yeah.
Right. But from Payton's perspective, if he had more of an impact, he'd still say, I was more effective defending this guy. And it got me thinking also to the point of, if you're a defender, there's also a point where you're like, no, I know I defended him well. He made the shot, but that doesn't change the fact that I know I defended him well.
Right, which I think, you know, we've seen plenty of quotes over the years from someone like Shane Battier when asked, like, about defending Kobe. It's like, you know, there's only so much, like, you do your work and then just hope he misses. For the most part, and there's only so much you can do. That actually brings up something that will help us eventually transition into the Bulls. But I feel like we misremember this '96 NBA Finals quite a bit. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and it's always thought of as like the Sonics really challenged the Bulls. And they really took it to them, and they had it. Like, I just feel like this is how it's. Remember, this is the narrative. It's like the Sonics, oh my God, you know, that Bulls team won 72 games, but the Sonics really took it to them and challenged them in the finals. And I'm not doubting that they didn't challenge them, but the Bulls were up 3-0 in the series.
3-0.
They won the first game by blowing them out in the fourth quarter. I mean, they were up 2 going into the fourth. They outscored them 28-13, big 17-point win. Second game's close. Third game, other than a third quarter flurry by the Sonics, the Bulls dominated that game. And so they're up 3-0, and then they lose two games in Seattle, and then they win game six by 12, I think. That's not like taking it to them. You're down 3-0 in the series.
Here's an interesting question. What was a closer finals, the 96 finals or the 2012 finals?
I would argue the 2012 finals.
Yeah, I would too. I would too, based off of how close every game was,
yeah,
and the way that it felt, even though it ended in 5 versus 6. I'm totally with you on that. I think it's mostly – a lot of it is that for the first 10 years after the Jordan era, there was this aura that surrounded them of invincibility, and everyone else – and this is always why I was never a Jordan guy, because everyone else got lost. Like, no one mattered except for the story about the Bulls and Jordan. And – there was kind of this, well, yeah, I mean, the Sonics were there, but they were just kind of like a prop. And then as we've gotten into more nuanced discussions, there's this push to be like, well, look, Gary Payton and Sean Kemp, that was a damn good team. That was a damn good team. You can be a damn good team and still not have come close to actually challenging the best team of all time.
Yeah, I agree. And I look at those, the two finals against the Jazz, I just think those were highly more competitive. Like, just absolutely more of a challenge and more competitive than the Sonics were in 96. And I don't know that anyone's necessarily disputing that, but I just feel like the Sonics were a much cooler team to appreciate than like the boring old pick and roll John Stockton, Karl Malone kind of milquetoast like feel of what they did, when in fact like that was much better basketball.
As someone who loathed Karl Malone in those years, I've grown since to appreciate him, but as someone who loathed him as a fan at the point in my life, it's mostly that I would argue you never – even though the Jazz were more competitive, you felt like in another universe the Sonics could have made a run at them. They just didn't, right? Like the result is that they didn't. Whether they could have is a different question. And Payton actually talked about this in the interview with Spears. They asked him about what he regretted more, and he talked about he asked him, like, what do you regret more, the 96 series or the 2004 series with the Lakers? Which is kind of an interesting question to ask, just because it's like, well, yeah, I think the one where I was the best player on the team is probably one that's going to mean more to me rather than that train wreck of a Lakers team that made the finals. He talked about how he thinks that he really focused on that 96 series to say, we couldn't go down 3-0. If we just managed to not have gone down 3-0, we really feel like we could have pushed them. We feel like we were right there. And it's like, well, yeah, but you didn't.
Right.
but you did not. You did go down 3-0. I just think it's interesting to kind of look at. It feels like the Sonics could have made a run versus, if you ask me, were the Jazz with Karl Malone ever going to beat the Bulls? And I would say no. There was no scenario in which I can ever imagine them beating them. And that, I think, has more to do with feel and style than anything else.
Yeah, so. I agree with that.
A whole bunch of interesting questions, though.
Speaking of feel and style, I feel like the style of Derrick Rose's game will be fun next year.
Smooth as frozen yogurt. Oh, That's what that was.
That is a transition. That is a transition.
Okay, let's do some percentages. Let's do this. Let's play this game. You got 100%, okay?
Okay.
And you can fit different kind of corollary results into these bigger categories if you list them. What are the odds that Derrick Rose comes back better than ever? What's the chance?
Are we saying right away or just looking at the next season as a whole?
I'll give him till January 15th. That by January 15th, we're saying, holy crap, Rose is better than ever.
I would give that a 65% chance.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the chances that he is never the same?
5%.
Wow. What are the odds that he has, regardless of what happens in the future, because I think you and I can both agree that this year isn't the defining for his career.
Right.
What are the odds that he has a fine but overall disappointing season?
I don't know, like 20%? 25%, yeah. Something like that.
Okay. Then you got like 10% left over that's for like whatever else.
Yeah.
Do
you want my reasoning for this stuff?
Do what?
Do you want my reasoning for this stuff?
Of course.
For these percentages?
Yeah, go for it.
Mainly because I think that we keep expecting like a lull every time someone comes back from an ACL injury because it's really hard to come back from. I mean, just dating back, like, you know, Rubio took time. Iman Shumpert has taken time to kind of get back to normal athleticism for them. Thinking about past ones like Al Jefferson and Corey Brewer all took time. Rajon Rondo we expect will take time. And Derrick Rose should take time. But he's also doing something that no one, at least not in recent memory, has done, which is he just sat out. Like, he just kept training. He didn't get back onto the court. And so I don't know how much of that will actually hurt his athleticism once he's back on. I mean, we think, like, oh, he's got to get back into game shape and blah, 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 which is true, which took, you know, just from personal experience of watching Ricky Rubio in person, it took him about a month and a half. And then after about a month and a half of coming back last year, he was, I would say, better than he was in the previous year, like just completely better as a player on both ends of the court and looks strong. And so I don't know if Rose will actually go through that same transition period of, oh, I've got to get stronger now. Like it'll have been 18 months by the time he gets back. Like, the strength should be there, I would assume. Even though he's not playing in NBA games, I think it will be there. And to kind of build off of that, the ACL injury is just no longer a career killer like we're so used to. I mean, you and I grew up, guys would blow out their ACLs and it was just like, ugh, well, that guy's never going to be the same again. That's not the case anymore. Like, the procedures, the training that comes after it, the physical therapy, like, it's so advanced at this point that I'm not saying it's good. I mean, it's not you're not hoping a guy blows out his ACL so he can come back stronger, but I think that it's such a likely scenario at this point that I don't think it will really affect someone as athletic and as incredibly gifted as Derrick Rose is. And I almost think it's going to, for certain guys, it'll end up being like, nowadays a pitcher can get Tommy John surgery and And people will say, oh, that guy's going to come back throwing harder than he was before because of just the physical mechanics that go into repairing it and the training afterwards, where it's almost looked at as like a, it sucks, you got to take a year and a half, but you're going to come back better. And I almost wonder if Rose will kind of be that jumping off point for the ACL injury.
There's a surgeon I follow on Twitter who talks incessantly about ACLs to the point where it's obviously self-serving to a certain degree, but he has some interesting comments about it, having the actual medical background. One thing that he was saying actually this morning is he was talking about how he thinks that we're going to be seeing in the next couple of years that guys are going to come back from ACL surgeries in season, that it's no longer going to be a season-ending injury where you can. We've seen it a few times if it happens in like the first month, but we're talking like out in January, back in April kind of thing, where like the recovery time is just going to keep getting shortened and shortened and shortened. It's odd that we're talking about this with a guy that took 18 months. And that to me is why I think I have more trepidation. I genuinely worry about the mental side of it because I guess part of it is you're right that the medical stuff has advanced. I worry we've seen enough players where we've looked at them and say their stories are, and then this injury happened, and quote, they were never the same again.
Right.
We've seen that consistently.
But
And
how many of those have we seen in the last 5 years?
that's a great question. That's a really great question because we haven't. You're absolutely
And
right.
I'm not posing that question to say, see, it's fixed. No, nothing to see here, folks. Keep moving along. Like, I don't know that that's the case. I'm just thinking of like recently or relatively recently. I look at them like, I don't know. These guys look pretty good now.
There's a lot more evidence of guys recovering completely than there is of them not. He went through a lot of trauma. That's kind of the other thing is that he clearly went through a lot of emotional trauma, and for a number of reasons, I have a better, not better. I have a good understanding of what that entails from a number of levels, not only from a personal but from a scientific standpoint. I've done enough research in the area to know that there are long-lasting effects that sometimes can occur, and it wouldn't surprise me. But at the same time, I could say that just about anybody. So I don't know that I'm probably attributing it because I'm concerned about what I've seen and the circumstances surrounding his injury, rather than any sort of like factual information. All of the data suggests what you are suggesting. Like the evidence at hand would lead me to believe that he's going to come back and he's going to be as good, if not better, than before. It's a huge question. I really wish he was coming back at home. I'm still annoyed that the NBA scheduled him for opening night in Miami. That bugs the crap out of me.
Is their first preseason game at home? That's the question. That's the return.
Yeah,
In your off-season report, you put that like the Red Knight Rises or whatever the hell that video was. And I watched it and I was thinking, and as I'm watching, I was like, you know, this is actually like a pretty well done like morphing of the Dark Knight Rises and this whole Derrick Rose thing and you know, LeBron James is evil, blah blah blah. I got about a minute into it and I was like, oh, these nerds and their Batman. I gotta get like I can't stand this anymore. I appreciated it until I watched about half of it and I was just like, I'm over this.
I was too lazy to pull up a photo. That's like what that comes down to. It's
No,
like
I thought it was a great addition because that's really what their offseason is about, right? I mean, they can tweak the roster as much as they want, but unless Derrick Rose is back, none of it
you want
really
to know
matters.
you want the reason I find that video interesting actually is from the perspective that I mean, you know me, like I find fan psychology fascinating, and I am just constantly fascinated by how much Bulls fans think that they are right there, that they are like. That 2011 series never happened. Just didn't happen. And I'm like, that team was much better than this one.
I don't know about that.
Oh, come on now.
I don't know
They
that
had
team.
Ashiq, they had you got Ashiq over Nazi Mohamed. I
Okay,
still
so you're losing some defense, but you're gaining a guy who can catch a basketball.
I'd still probably take Korver over Dunleavy. It's real close, though.
But I also think that you have improvements in Noah, you have improvements in Dang, you have Jimmy Butler. Well, maybe Dang's about the same. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe Dang's, I'll just say Dang's a wash. But you have Jimmy Butler now. I think you have an improved Taj Gibson, in just in
Who
terms of straight team basketball.
was
I think
JL3 their backup point guard in 2011?
that sounds right to me.
Because I would probably take Marcus Teague over JL3.
They still have Kirk Heinrich, right?
Yeah, so there you go. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right that they're better. I guess it just feels
They
better.
had C.J. Watson. He was, I
Yeah.
mean, he and John Lucas, I think, split time in the playoffs, maybe. No, Lucas didn't even play in the playoffs. It was just C.J. Watson.
My only memory of the 2011 season with JL3 was I know that he had like a great game against the Heat, but LeBron jumped over him and dunked.
Yes.
That's what I always remember.
Good God, Luol Deng played 43 minutes a night in 16 playoff games.
That's the other part of this. There's got to be some segment of you that says surely Tibbs's ridiculous masochism or sadism rather is gonna bite him eventually, right? Like they
Well,
can't.
that is much more of a concern, I think, than just a talent comparison between the two teams. Is that, that's just a lot of wear and tear on a guy. Maybe we'll see Luol Deng come in to this season. This is a contract year for him, correct? Feels
I
like a
don't know.
contract year.
I think it is. I think you're right. Yep, 14 million expiring.
Yeah, so contract year. Maybe he comes in the best shape of his life. Maybe he's lost 25 pounds and gained 25 pounds of muscle at the same time. As we'll get the preseason reports of him being in the best shape of his life, and maybe he'll be ready for the wear and tear. But that is a concern. And I'm not even worried about Jimmy Butler playing. He had all those games of 48 minutes or 47 minutes last year. I'm not worried about that necessarily. But Dang is the one where he might be the key to their entire ability to compete with someone like the Heat in a playoff series.
I think the idea is that with Dunleavy getting back, they've got the wing strength now to where they can sub out Butler and Deng and not have to necessarily play them both into the ground. They'll both play extended minutes. But that's been the thing though, is like he does it when he doesn't have to. He does it with 12-point leads.
Right, if Thibodeau was listening to this podcast, you said he'll have the ability to switch out Dang and Butler. He went, "What?"
Why would I do
Do what with
that?
the what now?
So I think that's going to be interesting. Boozer really did play pretty well last year.
Yeah, he was solid. He was really solid.
Comparative, I think it was more of a he played better than he had in previous seasons. He fell off towards the last part of the year, but overall, I mean, he carried them for a long time. I do think Heinrich does bring strength in terms of being able to say we don't have to run Derrick Rose out there for 35 minutes off the bat. We can put him at 30 minutes. We can sit him a game if he needs it. If he doesn't want to, if we don't want him to play back-to-backs, he doesn't have to because that's part of it is, he could be totally back to full strength and then just, wow, this is really causing some wear and tear. The knee's got a little bit of discomfort just because it's the first extreme activity after surgery. Even with it being so long ago, they don't have to do that.
Yeah.
And so they can protect him a little bit if they will, which again is a question.
And
I think my thing with
maybe that's where
my
Marcus
bigger,
Teague comes in,
yeah.
is provide like, okay, you have Heinrich and you have Teague. Maybe Teague is more in that Nate Robinson role of last year. I mean, probably not given that kind of responsibility on offense, but maybe just being able to throw those combinations out there, he can feel better about Rose resting more games if he decides to even do that. Who knows?
But I think the part of it though, I still get back to, I look at the core. And Jimmy Butler is big, but if you ask me, if Jimmy Butler had been on the 2011 team, would they have beaten the Heat? And I don't think so. I just think that the Heat are definitively better than this team, in my opinion.
Sure, but I mean, we're also looking at who is their starting shooting guard? Ronnie Brewer? No, it was Keith Bogans. Keith Bogans to Jimmy Butler is a huge upgrade.
That's true.
I
That's
mean,
true.
Bogans was really good defensively, but that's a huge upgrade. Now, I don't know that it's enough to really put the Bulls in that kind of area as the Heat in that tier. But to challenge him, That's a lot of wing capability to challenge a team that thrives with their wings.
I think we agree that they're a sub contender.
Yeah, I think I right now it, I think it's the Heat, and then in the second tier, it's probably the Pacers, the Nets, and the Bulls if Derrick Rose is back to his at least his regular self. And then I think you could probably put the Knicks in there if you wanted to, but if you put them in the third tier, I wouldn't have a huge problem with that. I could go either way on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a pretty deep sub-contender group in the East where, like we always say, if LeBron returns to his home planet, then I do think that Pacers, Bulls, Nets, Knicks are all right there. Any one of those teams could win the East. If we take the Heat out, any of those teams, I feel like it would have a good chance to win the East.
Yeah.
So it's not really an insult. It's just a matter of I feel like there's a Chicago sense that we're right there, and the Heat are our rivals, and the Heat are like, eh, bring us Roy Hibbert. And you got Noah, and that's a problem. But
Right.
the Pacers are a much bigger pain in the ass. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that Rose is one of the few players that LeBron is able to, one of the few point guards that LeBron's able to guard effectively.
Yeah, that'll actually be, I think Thibodeau said something recently about Rose has improved the range on his jumper, and God, who knows if that actually matter, like if that'll actually come to fruition in games. Like we hear this kind of thing a lot, in every preseason. But maybe, I mean, maybe if, let's say Rose gets to be a 37% 3-point shooter, which is for a guy like that would be incredible, right?
Right.
Is that enough to kind of neutralize the way LeBron James neutralizes him? Like LeBron's he's as quick as him, he's stronger and he's bigger. And that's where maybe Deng has to make you pay for taking Rose off of or taking LeBron off of him. Like I don't know. I don't know how that's the biggest problem with the thing. Not necessarily how do the teams match up. It's how do you free Derrick Rose of the stuff LeBron James has done to him in the past and just did to Tony Parker over the last two games of the NBA Finals.
Yeah. Rose is explosive. He's not savvy like Parker, and Parker gave them a lot of problems before his injury, bogged him down, and then LeBron did do work on him. But I feel like it's not a great matchup. We'll see. I think one of the things that's maybe cool about this Bulls team though is you look at it and you say, okay, they did topple the Heat's winning streak. They played them tight again this year. They weren't in that series really. But they were a problem. They were pesky in that series. And that was when that last year, that team, it wasn't just Rose. It was no Rose. Noah with plantar fasciitis. Luol Deng had a spinal tap thing, have a negative reaction, put him in the hospital.
Right.
Like, good God. Taj Gibson tore the knee. He had the knee injury. I mean, you had so many disastrous things happen to that team last year, and they still wound up with a fifth seed. And still wound up being a pain in the ass for Miami.
They are
That's got to
very.
be like your best case. My only problem is a lot of the times when you're a pain like that, it doesn't translate when you get back to full strength. That's going to be the question is, if you add in these pieces, does that combination make you better than you were, especially when you had that motivation of no one believes in us? Because now a lot of people are going to be believing in the Bulls. I think there's probably going to be some people that pick the Bulls to win the East. So
Oh, I don't think anybody would do that without. I don't think anybody who is. I don't think anybody who doesn't care about causing a reaction
yeah.
would do that without seeing Derrick Rose for a
Yeah.
month. I think that, you do bring up a good point of that team last year with all the problems. They kind of stuck together and they made themselves like a pain in the ass for everyone they faced. And when a team does come back to full strength, that's something the team has learned. But part of that was Nate Robinson, and I think that's not necessarily something that's easy to just assume that identity once you've gotten back to full strength, because now you start thinking instead of, oh, we just want to compete with everyone and show them like we're not going to be pushed over. Now you're switching to, we think we can win the title because we're back at full strength and we were there right before Rose's injury, and so it's just a different team mentality that can be an issue. So I think that's a really good point based on just like team identity and the team mindset. It would be unusual if it didn't change?
Tony Snell, I think, is a really interesting question, too.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with rookies, especially rookies in a draft like this, is everyone expects a first-round rookie to come in and get minutes.
And they don't.
And they don't. It's really hard for a coach to trust that, especially when you're such a contender. But I do think that Snell is the type of guy, because of his, you know, he's got a pretty decent all-around game. I think he'll be a really good defender on the NBA level once he gets comfortable. You know, I could see him earning minutes with Thibodeau and getting the trust right away, or within like the first month of the season.
That's part of it. Teague's probably going to fall out of the rotation, honestly.
Yeah, and he probably should, just based on what their goals are. Like, he's probably a year away from really being... Well, he's definitely a year away because Kirk Heinrich's under contract, you know, assuming Heinrich doesn't go down with another big injury. Where Teague is probably like a year away from really joining the rotation. Here's how they, I think, like, let's look at it this way in terms of their roster transformation from this offseason report. They switched out Marco Bellinelli and Richard Hamilton for Mike Dunleavy and Tony Snell, right?
Yep.
That's a pretty good upgrade.
Yep.
And then Malcolm Thomas, you know, he wasn't really around. I guess you could kind of put him in that. Do you think Eric Murphy can play at all? I wasn't big on him coming into the draft, and I even wasn't big on him even though he played well in Summer League. But I talked to a lot of people in Summer League. They're like, yeah, this guy he might be a steal.
Which, the shooting percentage really gave me pause.
Yeah.
When I saw his three-point percentage, I was like, oh, okay, that kind of changes my mind. This guy might be able to play a little bit. Second-round guys are even harder for me.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts because every fan thinks that they're second-round. Like, they always start talking like, well, I think that he's probably going to get minutes, but I'm like, do you have any idea how many of these dudes just get cut and are never heard from again?
Right.
Just never heard from again. And I'm a fan of almost all of them.
It is something, though, where this team isn't entirely that deep at the big man position. And so, you know, yeah, they've got Noah, Gibson, Boozer, and Nazi. That's a really nice four. But one of those guys goes down, you might need Murphy to step in and play some four.
Yeah, and they're also – the Bulls have been sneaky smart about stashing guys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of it is – Mirotić is going to come over, and Mirotić is a guy I'm huge on. When they get him next year, I think a year from now, I could be looking at the Bulls and realistically be saying, depends on what happens with LeBron in free agency, be saying, I really think the Bulls have a shot at the title. I could definitely see that happening.
Yes, absolutely. They,
because of how good they can get. They're going to get cap room. There's all this opportunity for them to get. Like, they can make it. That's part of the thing to me, though, with this team is – I honestly, there's a part of me that really believes that their management, that Gar Forman and Paxson, really thought after Rose's injury, we got to start looking at 2 years down the line. We got to retool. I think that there's a part of them that's really thinking about what's going to wind up happening when they've got Boozer as an expiring contract, when Deng is either off the books or re-signed it for a different amount, and depending on how Butler develops. They've got Butler. They're going to get Mirotić. They've got Gibson for a while. They want Teague, obviously, to improve, and that's a question mark. But they've got a little bit of young talent, and they're going to have the ability to add better guys.
Sure. The thing. You know, Royce Young, our buddy at CBSSports.com, made a good point about the Thunder a while back of – you know, this team is kind of set up for, you know, they almost became too good too fast. And they're really like designed to be a title contender like a year or two from now. And instead, like, they fast tracked everything because everyone developed and everyone was a hit basically of their draft picks. And then they got, you know, kind of forced into these bad decisions, or not a bad decision, but these tough decisions regarding like Harden's extension or whatever. And I think you could say something similar about just this Bulls team based on what you just said of maybe they're not, you know, everyone wants to look up, can they win this year? Can they win this year? And it's like, probably not, but God, they look set up for 2015.
Yeah, and they're going to be a great team this year, and they're going to be right there in the East, and they're going to have a really good shot at going forward. All they got to do is make sure Derrick Rose is okay.
Yeah.
That's why I went back to that constantly in that offseason report is, you know, this – and – you can be confident, you can be like you are, you can be unsure. It's a question. It's a question that's going to be debated, and it's going to be debated right up until that opening night.
And I think even deeper into the season, I think it's going to be debated, because every bad game, which he will have some, is going to be, see, he's just not ready yet. And then every good game is going to be, see, he's breaking out of it, and it's probably somewhere in between. Like, there will be an ebb and flow to it. I just think we'll look back at the entire season and think, yeah, this guy's back, and he's better.
I argued that the NBA should not have put him on opening night because there was a risk that he wouldn't play, because we just haven't seen him. And then I remembered, I thought about something else, and here's why it was a genius move to put him on opening night. Even in Miami, I still would have preferred him to open at home, but going on the road against Miami, this is why it's genius. If Rose has a 25.9 assist, 4 rebound game in that opener and the Bulls win, it's going to get nuts fast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've seen quite a bit of banner raising hangover over the years.
Yep.
And so it's kind of ripe for the picking of the Bulls could walk in there, watch the banner raise, you know, see the ring celebration, and then, you know, kind of put one on the Heat, come out with a win, and everyone starts immediately the conversation of, oh, is this Bulls team ready, you know, are they going to be able to challenge the Heat in the playoffs? It is kind of a genius move.
I mean, just from my knowledge of Bulls fans, if they win that game, people are going to start ordering their championship shirts. Like, you know, they're going to start commissioning the bust for Rose outside the United Center. Okay, I think, well, this is a good podcast in general, and we're going to do Pacers now?
Yeah, let's do the Pacers. You just scroll on down the page if you're on CBSSports.com, or scroll up on the page. They're both there. Or click on the old iTunes and subscribe and maybe leave us a 5-star review. Nothing less than 4 stars, though. That would really hurt my ego. Thanks, Matt.
Catch you on the flip side.
Don't ever say that again.